I don't know where everybody is.
Which one is she going to?
Steiner Hayward is this one. Blue Man's Horn.
Call House Committee on Healthcare together for this lovely April 27th and open up a public hearing on House Bill SJM4. My very own senator is here to talk about it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, member of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity. I'm Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, State Senator from District 17. Have the privilege.
Best, right?
The best by far. which I have the privilege of representing along with Representative Greenlick and Representative Helm. Here today to talk to you about SJM4. As you may remember, in 2013, this body passed Senate Bill 450, which was signed to put together the task force on the streamlined delivery of human services, which Ms. Teely Sirka ably staffed for us, as she usually does, in the interim. And we met very successfully for a little over a year with broad representation from both state agencies, various divisions of state agencies, and community organizations that serve people who are in need of human services, with an attempt to try to figure out some of the barriers for efficient delivery of human services and help people get back to self-sufficiency as quickly as possible. Three bills came out of that: SJM4, Senate Bill 444, and one more that the number I can't remember. And I apologize. But they all relate to some of the biggest barriers that we found. The first of which is communicating information, and that broke down into two categories, the first of which this bill addresses. And that has to do with how, under federal code 42 CFR Part 2, drug and alcohol addiction are treated differently from any other occurring any disorder, and they are treated that way for reasons relating to previous stigma around drug and alcohol addiction and prior to the understanding that these are biological diseases for which people have genetic predisposition and that require treatment just the same way diabetes or hypertension does. And so SJM4 is designed to urge our congressional delegation and the federal government as a whole to change 42 of CFR Part 2 so that drug and alcohol addiction are treated with the same level of confidentiality of any other medical or mental health disorder, but not with an excess provision, so that people, for example, who are treating, we heard a testimony, I sit on the Subcommittee on Human Services, we heard testimony this morning from two providers of emergency mental health services, one here in Marion County and one in Lane County, talking about how difficult it is when they have people with co-occurring disorders, including, for example, schizophrenia and drug or alcohol misuse disorders, often which come about because people are trying to self-medicate for these mental health issues. And yet it's very tough to communicate about these two issues because of federal HIPAA laws and how the courts have interpreted them. So SJM4 is simply our way of urging Congress to change that. And I would note, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that the Association of Oregon Counties brought a resolution to the national body representing counties about this very issue. And the National Association of Counties has made it one of its top priorities, exactly the same issue. So this body would be in line with other governmental jurisdictions who are recognizing the role that 42 CFR Part 2 plays in hampering our ability to help people who are most in need in our communities. Thank you very much.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
Madam Senator. You know, I hate these memorials because I think they go into a dumpster that Congress has just for these memorials.
Understood, sir.
Why don't we just pass a state statute overriding that and see if they take us to court on it?
Mr. Chair, if you were inclined to gut and stuff this, I'd be more than happy to support that, sir.
Well, you can't with a memorial.
So oh, with a camp memorial.
But we ought to take that seriously.
We got lots of bills. Mr. Chair, I would be more than happy. We can pass this one and do that.
I don't think this would stand up in court if we took it under modern times. I think it would be really useful to.
I think that's a really intriguing idea, and we should have a further conversation, but I would certainly support pursuing that path, because if we're going to help people, we have to understand that these are medical disorders just like so many others that Representative Bueller and I take care of on a regular
chronic
basis.
Chronic relapsing brain disorders, and
exactly.
That's what they are, and that's the
exactly
NIH
right.
definition of it.
No. Exactly, and that was not the case when 42 CFR Part 2 was passed, and the sooner we change all of that, the more we help to reduce the stigma associated with these diseases and allow people to get the treatment that they need and deserve. Happy to take any other questions, Mr. Chair, or member of the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for letting me go first so I can go chair.
I have to go back to Ways and Means.
I got to go back to Ways and Means. No,
I
actually like it. Money is policy, sir, so thank you very much.
Is Lori still here?
Yes, she's back in the back, so I do want to open
Senator it. Senator Mattis Anderson, why don't I open up at the same time Senate Bill 144A, and invite you to the podium. See if we make some mischief with your bill.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm State Senator Lori Mattis Anderson. I represent Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, Fairview, and some of East Portland. I'm going to be very brief. Telehealth is extremely important issue, and it was a very contentious issue. And I just want to commend the work group that I facilitated over the last 7 months since 2014. We had all sides, all stakeholders at the table working together, and this is a product that they came up with, and that's all I wanted to say, and I'll let the people who really know the issue come and testify.
Thank you for coming over. Yes. Representative Bueller.
Yeah. Senator, thank you very much for working on this. I think this is going to have a transforming effect on the way health care is delivered in a very positive way. You know, improve access markedly and really bring the way that we take care of patients into the 21st century. So thanks for all your efforts. I know you've been working hard on this for quite some time.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Bueller. It is an important issue. And I remember working at Clackamas County Public Health when we were just starting technology and what an onerous hardship it was for all these agencies to become computer savvy. But now we're getting into it where this is going to provide better access, better care, better transparency. I mean, it really affects everything. So, yeah, I'm excited for especially this stakeholders as well as the patients, of course.
Oh, good job. We'll treat it nicely here. Thank you. Let's go back to SJM 4. We have one witness on SJM 4. Two witnesses. Who do we have?
Karen Wheeler and Stacy Michelson.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Karen Wheeler, and I'm the Behavioral Health Programs Administrator for the Addictions and Mental Health Division at the Oregon Health Authority. And after the discussion that we've just had, that I've just heard, I would say ditto. We know the whole healthcare environment has changed. We now have coordinated care organizations. We have models of coordinated care that people are really trying to hold up to. We have electronic health records, and we have
patient-centered primary care homes.
Primary care homes. Yeah. We have prescription drug monitoring programs, so we just have a completely different landscape than we had in 1987, which was the last time this federal law was looked at. SAMHSA has been taking testimony and looking at it, but I hadn't heard anything recently in the last couple months about that. One of their key leaders left SAMHSA, so Dr. Wesley Clark left, and he was the head of trying to look at 42 CFR Part 2. So basically, that's all I wanted to say, is that we are definitely in support of anything that helps providers be engaged in this coordinated care model.
Hey, any questions? Thank you.
Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Stacy Michelson with the Association of Oregon Counties, here to speak in favor of SJM-4. As Senator Steiner Hayward mentioned, AOC has taken this on as an issue that we have supported and actually came to us from Lane County, wanted us to take this to the national level. And so Commissioner Pat Farr made a presentation at the Health and Human Services Policy Committee at the national level, and they unanimously recommended this as an issue that go to their board. And I will say it has also been a top priority for NACBID, the National Association of Community and Behavioral Health Directors, to just echoing Senator Steiner Hayward's comments that this is an issue that is gaining some traction on the national level amongst advocacy organizations, and I think we would likewise be interested in conversations about other ways to address this issue. So happy to talk about that further. Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
We'll close the public hearing on SJM 4 and go back to the public hearing we had started, which was SB 141A. Would you call the next panel, please?
Robert Dumig, Jessica Adamson, Elise Brown.
Whoever.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robert Dumig. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Office of Rural Health and a member of the board for the Telehealth Alliance of Oregon. I want to thank Senator Mona Sanderson for her leadership in bringing together our work group that brought you Senate Bill 144. This bill expands the requirements for health benefit plan coverage of telemedicine services by requiring that coverage be provided for services offered directly from a provider to a patient, regardless of where they are. Now, this includes homes, schools, and workplaces, and it requires that the Public Employees Benefit Board and the Oregon Education Benefit Board reimburse for telemedicine services as well. When Senate Bill 24 was passed in 2009 legislative session, telemedicine was used primarily between hospitals and other hospitals and clinics, and the reimbursement provided in Senate Bill 24 reflects that. In the 6 years since that session, telemedicine has grown and included areas of direct clinician-to-patient services. In order to be able to provide care when and where it is needed, a reimbursement was needed for the clinicians providing those services. And although Senate Bill 144 does require that these services be reimbursed, the amount of that reimbursement is not mandated. It is negotiated between the insurer and the provider when their contracts are negotiated. Senate Bill 144 also gives careful consideration to the conditions under which these services are provided. Attention was paid to language that would assure that the application and technology used to provide the services met all standards required by the state and federal government. And as with Senate Bill 24, insurers are not required to pay for services that are not covered under their benefit plan or to reimburse a provider that is not contracted with their plan. Again, this bill is a result of many months of work with all of the players at the table, and we are very pleased to bring that to you today and happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Let's have the whole panel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson with Providence Health and Services. Providence was pleased to participate in the work group on Senate Bill that ultimately resulted in the creation of Senate Bill 144. We had representatives there both as a provider and as a payer and looked at the issue really from both sides. Providence has invested a lot in telehealth technology and is very active in promoting the use of telehealth technology, and we believe that Senate Bill 144 represents a big step forward in improving access and, importantly, reducing costs. This is truly within the kind of sweet spot of the triple aim where we're trying to get to. And we fully support this legislation. There are two things that Mr. Dubig touched on, but that we are particularly pleased are part of this legislation. First, requirements that technology use needs to be compatible with state and local state and federal privacy laws is essential. It's important to protect patient privacy. We appreciate the work that this committee has done this session on privacy issues, and we believe that this legislation ensures that the technology use needs to be compatible with HIPAA. And second, that this is not a parity statute, but this is a payment mandate. So we believe that by allowing the rates to be negotiated between providers and payers, that we're going to be able to, in areas where it makes sense, reduce cost curve. In areas where there is limited supply, we'll be able to retain a network. But it does ensure that we are going to be able to take advantage of the cost savings that are possible through telehealth technology and pass those on to our consumers. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Elise Brown for LifeWise Health Plan of Oregon. Also a participant of the task force, which, again, the work began last April 2014 and went through October and yielded a very collaborative stakeholder agreed upon bill in Senate Bill 144. So LifeWise supports the bill for three reasons mentioned earlier, as Jessica Adamson said. Number one, these are three simple things that yield big results. Number one is the reduction in cost in the system. And number two, to your point, Representative Bueller, access, greater access to care, mainly in the rural and further distance locations. And then third, not mentioned, is just creating a better patient experience from time travel and even absenteeism for those who find this a better option than getting away and actually visiting. So again, to summarize, we also thank Senator Lori Montes Anderson for her leadership on this and the Telehealth Alliance in reaching out and getting a broad stakeholder group to the table, and the results speak for themselves. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Are there questions, this panel?
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. Jessica, I just want to make sure you weren't hedging in your comments of this would only be in areas of limited access.
Oh, Mr. Chair, Representative Bueller, I apologize if I sounded that way at all. No, we believe that this is represents an opportunity to very broadly provide telehealth services, and that the opportunity for people to take advantage of telehealth services, whether they're in rural Oregon or, frankly, somebody who has trouble getting back and forth to a doctor's office in downtown Portland, but this mechanism will allow them to communicate in a more patient-friendly way with their physician. That all of that is what we envision telehealth to be, and to be very helpful to patients and to providers.
One follow. And so will this become a standard part of Providence Health Benefit Plan offered to consumers?
This bill would make it part of everyone's health benefit plan, yes.
Okay, thank you. And LifeWise also?
Absolutely.
You mentioned HICA. Do you have more? Sorry. You mentioned HIPAA-compliant software. Is Skype HIPAA-compliant?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we do not use Skype as our platform. Providence Health and Services, our provider side, we use a company called American Well that has developed technology that is HIPAA-compatible. And so that we are able to protect our members' information. As a payer, we'll want to see a business associate agreement from anybody who is wanting to provide those telehealth services, where we're going to look at those contracts, because that is the standard at which we're going to be able to judge, is there, in fact, HIPAA privacy in place.
Well, Skype and FaceTime are two pretty common video communication mechanism. How will it be determined whether they are HIPAA compliant or not? How is that written into the bill?
Mr. Chair, it would be, as I understand it from my experts, you would need to be able to present to us, you as the provider would have to have a business associates agreement with Skype to say that there is a protection of that protected health information that's going from the patient to you, that third party vendor is able to protect that. We don't use Skype as that third party vendor. It's Providence, so I don't know whether Skype would or would not enter into a business associate agreement with a health entity to protect that information or not.
But what if a doctor's office decided they wanted to use Skype and then comes to, let's say, LifeWise for reimbursement? Would they be the ones that would check into whether Skype was HIPAA compliant? How would that discussion take place?
So I can speak for what Providence would do. If we have a contract with Dr. Smith, and Dr. Smith uses Skype to communicate with their patient, in order for us to agree to reimburse Dr. Smith the way this bill is written, we would say we want to see a business associates agreement that your technology is compliant with state and federal law. So the way the bill is written does not require reimbursement unless it's compatible with state and federal law. So that would be up to the payer and the provider to work that out. But as a payer, we would say, where's your business associate agreement? That's the kind of gold standard of, are you using technology? Are you using a third-party vendor that's got HIPAA-compatible technology?
So it would be up to each individual health plan to make that determination.
That's correct.
So whether it being HIPAA-compliant, huh? Does that make you comfortable?
Mr. Chair, Elise Brown for LifeWise. I need to check with LifeWise on that. There was plenty of discussion about privacy concerns, and I know at the end of the day, LifeWise is here again to support the bill. To answer your specific question, I would have to ask them, and happy to get back to you offline.
Well, I'm just worried that something like Skype is not as secure as other system is not. My guess is it's going to be the average physician or the average small groups says, well, we have Skype, we know how to use it, our patients have it, let's just go with it. And that might be the right answer, but it might not. And the question is, how would that question be answered?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Comment or question. Chair Greenlee, I also share your concern that possibly the insurer would have a proprietary system that would be costly or cost prohibitive for practices to be certified in terms of compliance, or could there be independent OHA or some other organization that certify HIPAA compliance, so we wouldn't get into this kind of problem saying that you would question the compliance of the system that the practice is using.
Mr. Chair, Representative Buehler, I want to be very clear that when I talk about the proprietary system that Providence uses, I'm speaking of Providence as a provider. As a payer, Providence Health Plan does not have a specific system that we would require any provider to use only this system to receive reimbursement. We would want to see if they are using a system where's the business associate agreement with that third-party vendor to make sure that they too are on the hook to protect patient confidentiality.
What would you like to see in that agreement?
We would want to see that one exists, and I can't get any further than that because I'm not the contract people. But I'm happy to get back to you on what we would look for in that.
Yeah. Why don't you ask him whether they accept Skype while they're at the end?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Robert Deming with the Office of Rural Health. One of the issues and the reason the business agreements are important and that we didn't put a lot of some of the specifics on that is technology is changing very quickly, and so allowing that technology to do so without coming back to the legislature each time is kind of important to allow telemedicine to work. I think that it's important to remember that the providers are on the hook for that information about their patients, and so to utilize a system that is not compliant with HIPAA creates a larger liability for them and sort of builds within that relationship between the provider and the payer.
Buehler has another question.
Representative Buehler.
Sorry to keep on pushing
on this. We have plenty of time, I think.
So what happens if there's a disagreement between the provider and the insurer in terms of HIPAA compliance, where one says it's fine and the other doesn't? Who mediates that? Can the Office of Rural Health or OHSU be that independent third party? I mean, we all want to protect patient information. But what happens if there's a disagreement in terms of the robustness of that protection?
Mr. Chair, Representative Buehler, that would be between the providers and the payers to work that out.
We'll be back here next session.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Is Zoom Care going to be testifying?
They're going to be here in a minute.
Because I believe they use Skype as well.
I saw him lurking back there.
Widener.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Lively, welcome.
Thank you. Just wondering why we couldn't put together where these are the certified carriers, where you have two or three for people to select from. So whether it's WebEx, GoToMeeting, and Skype, or whatever, where you pick different ones that the provider could use, and these are our certified providers that are HIPAA compliant.
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, we felt that we look at where the law has been since the passage of Senate Bill 24 to where we are with 144 today, and the changes in just 6 short years have been dramatic. And we didn't want to try and, through legislation, pick two or three and say these are the ones that are going to be, when we know that every year more and more secure providers are coming online that provide this technology in a way that is consumer friendly. So that's, I think, for us, we don't want to be in a position of precluding providers or anyone else from selecting technology that is emerging and better through legislation.
But you might require that agreement you talked about and require as a part of that agreement that the provider certify that it's HIPAA compliant.
That's correct. We may do that. And this legislation would permit that. But it doesn't
require that.
It does not. An insurer could choose to contract with somebody who is not HIPAA compliant, and there's nothing about this bill that prevents that. But it does allow insurers to say, we want to see evidence that this technology is HIPAA compatible before we're going to reimburse for that.
Did you have another question?
I was kind of following up. You sort of went the same lines, because that's, I mean, you wouldn't want to do it legislatively because technology changes and everything in coding. I'm just wondering why it just wouldn't be handled by rule, and every one of these companies that wants to be used, they would just say, okay, here's what we do to guard patient safety. And if it matches up with the set of standards that we have, because it'd have to be an IT person that would do all this. And then you just say, okay, these are the ones that are have shown that they are HIPAA compliant or secure. So.
Okay, well, let's have the next witness. Madam Minister.
Mr. Bergstein.
You can go.
Len Bergstein from Zoom Care, please.
Well, did see him lurking.
Where is everybody else? I need him.
You have to bring your own support.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Len Bergstein. I represent Zoom Care, and I'm pleased to be here in support of Senate Bill 144. I have three reasons that I've tried to distill from the testimony we provided. We provided written testimony and also a study, original research report that was done in Oregon. It was a product of OHSU, Zoom Care collaboration, make sure that we could determine the feasibility of telemedicine in Oregon, and happy to say that the report is there for you to look at and demonstrates that, in fact, there is that telemedicine is feasible and it's efficacious in the providing of care. So there are three good reasons to support this bill and lots more, and I'm happy to talk about anything you'd like to talk about this, because it's an important issue to us, and I believe, as Representative Buehler said, this is a transformative technology. First of all, increasing access to telemedical services is proven to be sound policy in state after state. More and more studies are showing this, including the study I just referenced in Oregon, the Journal of Telemedicine and Telecare. Second point is that telemedicine empowers patients. It defeats barriers to care, and it is a competitive force to drive down the cost of care, which I think is all the things that your committee is working on so effectively and has been for the past couple of sessions. The third point is that 144A is a product of a thorough and transparent process. As has been mentioned before, it's been a collaborative process. Obviously, Senator Mona Sanderson was a driving force. Kathy Britton from the Telehealth Alliance of Oregon was critical. And we participated as both a provider and a payer. We are an insurance company, and we will be submitting, as other people will be, rates and forms filings at the end of this month. month, and we'll demonstrate, I think, to the marketplace that telecare is exactly what you know it is, which is a transformative force to be able to provide access, drive down costs, and really deliver the kind of care that you would like and that you would like your families to have. So that's it with my comments, and I'm happy to answer questions. It sounds like technology is an interesting topic.
It's going to be an interesting topic. Mr. Ken Geyer, did you have a... Oh, I'm sorry. President Buehler?
Yeah, thanks, Chair Grindley. Glenn, how many other states have this policy already in place and active?
I think there are about 21 that I've been able to track. Okay. One recent that we talked about in your office, Texas decided to go a different way, and we're hoping that there'll be a weather vane for you in this case, as they are in other policies, that you would go exactly the opposite way Texas would go.
That's good policy anyway.
Mr. Chair, just I think more comment. I've been sitting here reflecting on my neighbor who has suffered a severe stroke, and they have to call Metro West Ambulance to transport her. It's at a minimum a five-hour ordeal to get to Northwest Portland from Canby, Oregon, and back and wait and do all the stuff. And my guess is, you know, they can have an aide there probably to help do a few little things and cost a fraction of the time, the energy, and the money. It's just another example of how this could be managed so much better.
Good comment. Good afternoon, Rep. Hayden.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here. Chair Greenlee, thank you. I've got a question regarding the technology. We don't usually talk about technology too much here. But if we were able to support some significant legislation, which I believe would curb the cost of health care, and we certainly need to require that any transmission of private medical information stay that way. Having said that, there are breaches routinely in all parts of the business sector on information technologies. But would you support and would, in your opinion, would it make sense if we get there legislatively to say, listen, Oregon is joining some other states and moving forward on this, and we're going to put out a request for proposal to have private companies bid and show us that they can have those agreements and they can prove that they will be able to reasonably keep this information private, and the CEO is willing to sign a statement that information is going to be held privately. Is that something that you see feasible and would support?
Chair Greenlee and Representative Hayden, I think the wording of the bill was the right way to go on this. I think what we came down to after a lot of testimony on this, experts and others, was to leave this up to the contract between the providers and the payers. There's an enormous amount of evidence and discussion going on nationally. There are attempts to make national standards about the privacy issues. There are attempts, I think, to figure out whether the right phrasing is HIPAA compliant or HIPAA compatible. There are lots of ways to go at this, and I believe that the best policy here is the one that's technology neutral, that allows this the marketplace to make those decisions, the provider and the payer coming to contract, and that those standards be quite high. Our lawyers spend a lot of time talking about Skype and thinking about whether or not that's in fact holds up our requirements on privacy, and we hold patient privacy to be quite high. You and I have talked in your office about the significant, what kinds of information could be available if there were a breach, and I know that you have deep concerns about this, and I recognize those and appreciate those. Our lawyers say that in addition to what is said before in testimony about business kind of agreements, that there is a conduit exception for the technology that transfers the information, that in fact you're talking about a pipe basically that's taking the information from one place to the next, and it's not that the information is kind of open. So that in fact our lawyers would look to, in the case of Skype, to a conduit exception to the business agreement language. But we would be be prepared.
Wait a minute. What did you just say?
I knew that was coming.
There's a conduit exception.
Doesn't have to be compliant. It can be compliant at one end and the other end, but it doesn't have to be compliant in the middle.
Because because it's the pipe that's taking it, just like the information that goes over a cable or any other kind of system. The technology the process should be technology neutral. It should be what the outcome is in terms of the privacy of the document. The pipe that transfers between the patient, or the provider, and the patient is not open to be. Nobody's going to get into that information. It's either end.
So I mean, there is a difference between a sewer pipe under the street and an open sewer trench. They both move sewage from one place to another.
Right.
That pipe is either a nice, secure underground pipe that people can get to, or is an open trench that is accessible. And that's a...
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Yeah. This is my pipe consultant.
Don't take the call, that's fine.
No.
I mean, that's the issue. The issue is the pipe secure? Or can anybody driving by the street tap into that pipe? Oh.
Chair Greenlick, we believe, and our lawyers believe, that in fact we can meet a standard that says that in fact the pipe is secure without requiring someone to kind of dictate what the technology is for that.
But I think that's all we would be asking for, and I think that's what Representative Hayden was raising issue. You can't say there's a pipe exemption, which means we don't have to certify that the pipe is secure. I hope you didn't say that.
Well, I think that our lawyer would give you some cases where there is a conduit exception to the question about
it. We can give you some statutory denial of that.
Chair, I realize it's open to discussion. We believe, and again, the testimony that people gave, the experts gave at the task force that we worked on, said that the process of privacy was as important as any specific technology designation at the beginning.
I absolutely agree with that. But that process, I would suggest that process needs to be a secure process. It is the process. It's not brand A, brand B, brand C, brand D. It's a brand that is certified as being HIPAA compliant. It would seem to me that ought to be a piece of the statute.
Well, again, Chair Greenlick, and with all due respect, I think we're willing to support language if you can come up with language that talks about specific standards or guidance. We think that the way that the bill as it stands now addresses that issue in the best way, to allow the contract between the provider and the payer to designate, to make sure that, in fact, the standards are upheld. We know, everybody at this table knows, that the HIPAA regime, the compliance regime, is probably one of the most strict and robust regimes there exists in medicine, and that in fact the penalties for being at breach for a provider or a payer are significant, and those penalties we believe are strong enough to make sure that people find their way to a HIPAA compliant or compatible solution.
I think it's also safe to say that this technology has not been very well tested in the HIPAA regime yet. The HIPAA regime predates OMS.
If you would like, Chair Greenlick, I can go back and get you some. I think there's a fair amount of testing.
Representative Hayden, I think I interrupted you.
Just a final comment. I support the idea of telemedicine. I think there is some very good applications for it for us, but I do also support that we need to do it confidentially and safely. And I believe that there's if you take Nike or Intel or any of the companies that trade on the stock market and they transfer information through the pipeline, they have a very, very vested interest in securing that. So they may be able to have an exemption because they are going to make sure that that information doesn't get compromised because it's proprietary to their company for the next Air Jordan or whatever. In healthcare, I think the reason we have HIPAA regulations, even though some of us as healthcare providers struggle to get through all of it, we do support it because there doesn't seem to be that financial incentive or that proprietary incentive built in, and so that's why we have these, or in part why we have these HIPAA regulations. So I think it's important that the entire network, including pipelines, are included under the umbrella of privacy and protection, and I think we're talking about I can't say the word right now, but we're talking about words versus actual infrastructure here on how we do that. But I think those words are important that keep the information private.
Chair Greenlee and Representative Hayden, we agree with you. I'm trying to comment on the kind of pretty robust legal discussion that's going on at the national level about this very topic.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the hearing on Senate Bill 144A and open the hearing on Senate Bill 146. Madam Administrator, what do we have?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 146 modifies the definition of small employer to permit in-state employers with out-of-state employees to qualify as a small employer. This left the Senate floor 27 ayes, 1 no, and 2 excused, Mr. Chair. We have Mr. Holt here to speak to the bill, and there's no revenue or fiscal impact on the bill.
Are there other witnesses as well?
Just Mr. Holt.
Mr. Holt, you're on your own. You think you can handle it all right?
I think I can manage, sir.
Good, good.
Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt with Cambia Health Solutions here in support of Senate Bill 146. I guess, ironically, given the order of things today, a bill made necessary by the evolution of technology since the time that small group regulation was enacted by this body in the early 90s. The law today states that in order to buy small group coverage, a business has to have a majority of its employees located within the state. Well, with the expansion of small group going up to 100 employees from the present cap of 50 employees, there are a number of Oregon-based employers, who have employees scattered all over the place thanks to the Internet, which became more widespread after adoption of this statute. And so what the bill does is it simply says that if you are headquartered in Oregon, that should be good enough. And the problem that that's addressing is that we don't want to have employers who have been doing the right thing, buying coverage for years, suddenly be sort of in a no man's land where they're now a small group would become a small group by definition, but not be allowed to buy small group coverage because the majority of their employees are located outside the state.
It's not just headquartered in the state. It's having less than 100 employees in the state, right?
It's the new...
I mean, Nike wouldn't be qualified as a small group under this.
Right. Nike would be a large group. The law now is that if you are a small employer, you must, to qualify to buy coverage, a majority of your employees must be located within the state. And so what the bill would do is add to that and say that if you're headquartered here, then you also may buy a small group coverage if you are defined as being a small group.
So right, for your employer.
It affects that group of employers who have 51 to 100 employees. We researched, and it's in OLIS, the origins of the statute. We could find no reason in any of the hearing record from the early 90s of why this provision was even there in the first place. And we, I should also note, we've been working with the insurance division on potentially including this in the House bill that you just passed out of here last week, 2466. So hopefully that will get trued up. But in the meantime, we have this bill as a vehicle available if needed.
I want to understand. If they're housed in Oregon and have less than 100 employees total, wherever they are they covered by this? Or are they covered if they're housed in Oregon, have 50 employees in Oregon and 450 somewhere else? Do they cover those 50 under a small group plan? Those are two different things.
Chair Greenlee, that's a great question. It's the total number of employees. So let's say they had 40 employees here and 55 employees in various other places. Once the small group size goes up to 100 under the ACA, that company would then be a small group for purposes of the insurance statutes, and they would need this fix.
And if they had 40 here and 70 somewhere else, they would no longer qualify.
If they have 40 here and 70 somewhere else, then they will be a large a large employer today, and they'll be a large employer in 2016, and nothing changes for them.
Another question? Thank you.
Thank you,
sir. We passed 2466 off the floor today.
Yes, it did.
I think I did.
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
And we hope to address it in that bill. As you know, sir, we've all been looking at the fresh language, and we're confident of getting that resolved.
Maybe. Thank you. I close the public hearing on House Bill, on Senate Bill 146, and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 148. What do we have here, madam?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 148 left the Senate floor. 25 ayes, 5 noes, no excused, minimal fiscal impact, no revenue impact in the bill, increases the Board of Pharmacy memberships from 7 to 9 members. It identifies licensed pharmacy technicians to the new membership position, requires that the licensed pharmacy technicians to be in good standing, engaged in duties, and have 3 years of experience, directs the governor to appoint the licensed pharmacy technicians for terms beginning January 1, 2016. This also has an emergency clause, effective on passage. And we have two individuals signed up, Mr. Chairman.
It adds two techs, right?
It adds two. It increases the membership from 7 to 9, with those two new positions being pharmacy technicians.
Would you call the witnesses, please?
Beth Cook and Chris Jorkland. Sorry for the mispronunciation.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Beth Cook, and I represent United Food and Commercial Workers Local 555. UFCW represents over 20,000 members in Oregon and Southwest Washington. About 2,500 members of our local are within the healthcare sector, and I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 148A. Oregon's pharmacy technicians were licensed by the legislature in 2005. Oregon has a very long history of having stakeholder representation on boards and commissions, and there are currently no pharmacy technicians on the board. The current Oregon State Board of Pharmacy model lacks adequate representation by pharmacy technicians under this model. UFCW feels it is important to have the voice of pharmacy technicians on the board and urges your support of Senate Bill 148A. As the committee administrator Sandy said, this would require that, you know, the pharmacy technicians be currently licensed and practicing and have at least 3 years worth of experience within the field. I appreciate your time today, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Chris Bjorklund, and I'm here to speak in support of Senate Bill 148. I have been in the pharmacy technician for the last 16 years with Kaiser Permanente in Clackamas, Oregon. My license is regulated by the Oregon State Board of Pharmacy. The board oversees my continuing education, requirements, and disciplinary processes. As a member of this profession, I feel it's important that my peers have adequate representation on this board. I do appreciate the board's recent survey of pharmacy technicians to gain input, but simply not enough. I urge you to support Senate Bill 148. Thank you for your time today, and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Is there any questions this morning?
No question.
Senator Hayden.
Chair Greenlick, thank you. I just have one question on this. Would the new members to the board on pharmacy support a global website reporting for disciplinary action?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Hayden, I cannot answer that specifically. We do not, without consulting with the local further, but I'd be happy to get back with that information to you.
Okay. So in the interim, it's something that they're going to be working on, that all 18 boards. Mm-hmm. Just a question.
Good. Okay, thank you very much. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 148A. open a public hearing on Senate Bill 227. Madam Administrator, what have we got?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 227 left the Senate floor with 24 ayes, 6 noes. It allows the director of the Emergency Medical Services Trauma Registry Program within the Oregon Health Authority to adopt rules establishing a registry of brain injury trauma information. This has no fiscal, no revenue impact, and we have one individual to speak to the bill, Lisa Millett.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Lisa Millett, and I'm here to testify on behalf of the bill on behalf of the Oregon Health Authority. I'm the Injury and Violence Prevention Section Manager, and part of my job is I oversee the State Trauma Registry and the EMS data systems for the trauma programs in the state of Oregon. What this bill actually does is it sets up within the trauma registry a subset of data that we can use to examine.
Trauma registry is already in existence.
Trauma registry
it has
exists,
been for some time.
Has been here for a long time. And one of the problems with the statute that established the trauma registry is it doesn't allow us to use the data to determine how to prevent trauma from happening. And so what we want to do is, one of the really big issues in trauma these days is traumatic brain injury. In fact, in Oregon, the leading problem where trauma is escalating in the state is among people 55 and older, otherwise known as geriatrics, who fall and receive a head injury. And so one of the things we would like to do is set up a trauma registry so we can start learning more about those injuries and helping to prevent them, which is part of the purpose of having a trauma system and a state trauma advisory board. Thank you.
Are there questions?
Representative
Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess this is something we've dealt with a few times with trauma or head injuries especially. I'm just wondering, are you accumulating the data on like head injuries at the high school, junior high level from sports and athletics, things like that as well, that go through some of the school-based health clinics?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Widener, and other members of the committee, what we'd be doing is we'd start with a TBI registry. We'd start with the worst cases. We'd take data from the trauma registry, and those are the most severe cases. They're people that are seen in the ED and generally admitted to the hospital. Not all of them. Some of them are mild cases, and some of them are actually concussions. Eventually, we would add to those cases data that we have from emergency department visits so that we'd have sort of the whole scope of brain injury seen in practice. And those are just the brain injured persons that actually reach an ED or a hospital. And there are a lot of people that receive concussions and brain injuries that don't make it to an ED or hospital. They might be taken care of at the scene by a paramedic, and their coach may deem them appropriate to go home. They might see their primary care provider, and they might lay off for a week or two of games, but they would never need to go in to get a CAT scan or MRI or have any sort of advanced care that you might get when you're hospitalized or you go to an ED. I myself fell 3.5 weeks ago and got a concussion, and I didn't go in for advanced care. I went to urgent care. We lined me up with a CT to make sure I didn't have a brain bleed, but my case wouldn't make it into the trauma registry because I wasn't that seriously injured. So what I'm trying to tell you here is that there are lots of cases of TBI that would never make it into this kind of a registry, and we'd have to estimate what those numbers were.
May I follow up, Mr. Chair? Do we have a good idea, or do we keep track of brain injuries that are happening at the youth level? Because it's been one of the things, because we've had it with youth coaches having to administer this and everything, and I'm just wondering, how do we get a good grasp on this with a lot of our youth that are out there with head injuries from sports, from just playing at school, from soccer, from all kinds of different things? Because I think that's where one of our bigger areas are, and a place where I have a lot of concern. So there's a lot in a lot of our youth and athletics. So are we recording any of that information or getting an idea of what's happening out there whenever a paramedic looks at them? Do they record any information, or does the school nurse, does she record, or nurse practitioner record anything when she sees somebody come in with a head injury back to your department, or are we just going sight unseen on all of that?
Representative Greenlick and members of the committee, those are really good questions, and I can tell you that the only way we at the health division know about a head injury is if it ends up in an administrative data set like the hospital discharge index or the emergency department data or even in all payer all claims. It could end up in there. Many times the problem with a claims data set, which is huge, is that...
I think the answer to the question is no.
Yeah. Well, yes. Yes, that's correct. Yes. It's no.
We don't gather that kind of data now in any systematic way.
Representative Greenlick, in a systematic way, no. And I guess what I was trying
but
to...
But we kind of have a global way. Number is what I'm hearing.
The global number is missing. We try to estimate what the global number is using other resources, but we can't confirm for sure. There's no reporting mechanism for that.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, treat this kindly. It's a good mission. I close the public hearing on Senate Bill 227 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 229. Madam Administrator.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 229 left the Senate floor, 27 ayes, 2 noes. Pardon me, there's a fiscal statement on OLAS, no revenue. This requires the members of the Consumer Advisory Council who advise the Oregon Health Authority Director on provisions of mental health services to be compensated by the authority for performing council duties. And we have Mike H.L. is all I'm going to say. Helebechuk?
Liebechuk.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, I am Michael Liebechuk, Director of the Office of Consumer Activities within the Addictions and Mental Health Division of the Oregon Health Authority. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 229, which seeks to allow the Addictions and Mental Health Division to compensate members of the Oregon Consumer Advisory Council for participation in council and subcommittee meetings. AMH brought this bill forward to remove a barrier to broad and inclusive participation by council members, people who serve on the council. This change is supported by the division's philosophy and policy that consumers should be reimbursed for serving in an official capacity to provide input into service delivery and policy to AMH. The current language in statute states that members are not entitled to compensation or reimbursement expenses. And this is in conflict with AMH's current ability to compensate consumers who sit on other boards and commissions and councils, other advisory committees, that is. When considering appointments to the council, statute directs AMH to strive to balance representation by geographical area and age. Accordingly, AMH has appointed people from the far reaches of the state. However, because of our inability to reimburse members for their participation and particularly their travel expenses, we have lost many members from the far reaches of the state. Individuals with mental health and substance abuse disorders, as you may know, are in the lower echelons of the financial strata. They don't earn as much because of challenges with their psychiatric disability and substance use disorders. Providing expenditure reimbursement for and compensation for participation on the council is vital to ensuring meaningful participation by consumers of behavioral health services and their family members. Providing participation stipends and travel reimbursements to members of the council, it's consistent with statute which states, and this is statute that pertains to public council council meetings and commissions, etc. States, except as otherwise provided by law, all members of state boards and commissions, including those employed in full-time public service, may receive actual and necessary travel or other expenses actually incurred in the performance of their official duties within the limits provided by law or by the Oregon Department of Administrative Services. We're not allowed to do this, however, currently. If this bill is approved, we will use federal block grant dollars, so the fiscal impact in terms of general fund will be zero. So we will use block grant dollars for reimbursement and for compensation. This will make a huge difference in people's ability to sustain participation in the council. There's one person who drives up from Grants Pass. Our meetings are every other month, and every other month he incurs an expense of approximately $300 or approximately $1,800 a year. This is really a challenge for somebody who has a challenge financially, as do most of our members. So we value the input that individuals who have received services or are receiving services can provide. Input from the perspective of individuals who have received services into the system that they receive services from, I believe, is vital for shaping policy and service delivery. At AMH, we value this, this bill would allow the state to reduce the burden on these individuals who have been providing this input and show its appreciation for the time, travel, and guidance that members have been giving up to this point and will give in the future. The council is composed of appointed members from across the state. If this concept is not approved, participation in the Oregon Consumer Advisory Council will continue to be a financial burden for the members, and representation will be negatively impacted. Accordingly, AMH urges passage of Senate Bill 229 as it will remedy this financial burden to council members and bring the Oregon Consumer Advisory Council in line with statute that directs agencies to provide stipends and travel reimbursements to members of the Oregon Public Commissions, committees, and councils. Thank you for this opportunity to testify, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I think it's really important to have input from around the state. I can see the dilemma. I'm just curious about teleconferencing and whether you're moving at all in that direction.
Chair Greenlick and Representative Kenny Geyer, we have historically and we continue to open the lines for telecommunicating, and we found that it's difficult for people on the other end of the phone. We have a large meeting. 25 members are appointed, up to 25, and we have many visitors, so we're in a large room. And we have three Star Trek phones or whatever dispersed around the room, and the tentacles that come out from those, and it still doesn't seem to work well enough for people to continue to want to participate that way. Some do. But some do not, and they drop off the council. And we haven't moved to VCon. I don't know if that would work well or not, but I do know that what we've been doing hitherto has not worked well enough to maintain the participation at levels that we would like.
Thank you.
Question?
Yes.
Thanks, Chair Greenlick. Is there a precedence? Is this new, or are there other councils that have this kind of provision?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller, members of the committee. This provision was written into statute when the statute that I believe it's 370 430073 that passed during a time of economic downturn in the state. Ways and Means was not about to, in our estimation, allow a bill to pass that had any fiscal impact at the time unless it was absolutely essential to the governing of the state. For that reason, we wanted a zero impact bill. I chaired the council while it was an informal body for 8 years, and we wanted a formalized council, and the only way we could do it was with zero impact. Accordingly, written into the concepts of the bill and the final statute was that there would be no reimbursement.
But his question was, do we reimburse other members of other councils.
Oh, yes. Every other council. I apologize. Yeah. I misunderstood your question. Every other council. That's we're able to do it in every other instance. In this instance, it was written in statute that we could not for the reasons that I gave mistakenly.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Can I just one point of clarification? How the summary is written, it seems to be inconsistent with the text, or maybe I'm just confused, which that could be. But are we compensating for just expenses, or are we also compensating for performance of duties?
Thank you for your question, Chair Greenlick and Representative Bueller, other members of the committee. There would be a $50 stipend for participation for each meeting for individuals who are not there representing their employer. If they're there on their own time, they're a member of the council, they would be entitled, according to this bill, a $50 stipend.
And expenses?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Hayden.
So that brought up one question. When you say representing their employer, does that mean if they are any public employee, they are representing their employer?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Hyde, and members of the committee, I think I used a poor word. If they are there on their employer's time, some employers will cover the costs, and, not the costs, but the time that individuals have on the council. There are a couple of individuals for whom that is the case. In most cases, people there who are employed go on their own time. But in a couple of cases, their employer pays their salary.
Specifically about public employees.
And regarding public employees, to the best of my knowledge, there would be no instance where a public employee during his own time or her own time would be reimbursed. Beyond that, I do not know. I mean, would receive a stipend. I apologize. And as to whether or not we have public employees on the council, I was on the council as a public employee. I certainly would not be entitled to a stipend while I'm serving on the clock. I've never thought about, I don't know, to be honest, not being an attorney, whether or not a public employee who decided to take the day off to serve on the council would get a stipend. I imagine that might be true. I don't know.
Okay, so to follow up. So to shorten that, we're not just talking about civilian participants who happen to be perhaps diagnosed with a mental disorder of some point in the past. We're talking about everybody is qualified for the stipend, but some may not choose to do it based on their employer relationship.
Chair Greenlick and Representative Hyden, I can't speak with any certainty on these aspects of the finer points of what might become law. I can say that everybody who is appointed to the council has lived experience with a substance abuse disorder or a mental health issue. I myself as well. I served on the council during a time because I was asked to do so. And to the best of my knowledge, there are no other state employees who are members of the council.
But they still aren't on the council representing an agency. Right?
There are members who are not represented in an agency, but their agency supports their participation and may pay them during the time that they are there. In as much as they wouldn't be required to take time off. In such instances, they would not be entitled to the stipend. However, they would be entitled to reimbursement for travel expenses.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 229, and we are adjourned.
Nicely done.
8 o'clock.
Nicely done.
8 o'clock.